Welcome to Evening Under Lamplight, the show that invites you to attend. I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, and this is Cambridge Community Radio, Cambridge 105. And when I tell you that the email address is lamplight@cambridge105.fm and the archives can be found at momentsunderlamplight.com, then we've finished with the technical details and can move on to what's awaiting us on this evening's show Under Lamplight. But no, wait. Before we move on, here's a hot announcement I have to share with you. In September 2007, a nervous DJ, Patrick Wittes, presented his first live radio show on 209 Radio. Headstand has been a regular fixture online and on the Cambridge airwaves ever since, featuring an eclectic selection of music and spoken word. You know Headstand. You've probably just been listening to it on Cambridge 105 just before Evening Under Lamplight. Well, now we're all invited to celebrate the 5th anniversary of Headstand on Friday, 28th of September, that's this coming Friday, at 7 o'clock at PM, of course, at The Fountain at 12 Regent Street, Cambridge. Oh, and here's a list of some of the poets who will read there. John Guy, Faye Roberts, Leanne Moden, Patrick Wittes, Malcolm Guite, Ian Cartland, Anthony Fairweather, Nicky Marone, Glenn Hutchinson. And there will be music from Tom Adams, the Spaghetti Faction, and more. The event will take place on the first floor function room of The Fountain. Admission is free, but donations are welcome. Oh, yes. And if you'd like to perform, please contact Patrick at headstand@cambridge105.fm. But Patrick is right here in the studio. Have I said everything that needs to be said?
Yes.
Yes, he's pleased. And you'll be pleased too. I'll see you there. Now, our last show, you will remember, examined the concept or the space of Ainoma. A-I-N-O-M-A. A term I learned about from Joel Upton of Amherst College. Ainoma is the area in a Japanese temple connecting the sanctuary with the worship hall, a place in between where the two things merge, but not quite. You are neither in the sanctuary nor the worship hall, and yet you could also be said to be both in the sanctuary area and the worship hall. And then the term can be extended to a symbolic meaning of any in-between space, or state of mind, or heart, or imagination, in which we are balanced between two aspects, or two different moods or attractions. We are never here faced with either or, but always with being both one and the other, or neither one nor the other. Ainoma describes a particularly sacred space, a place of stillness, and also of dynamic tension and uncertainty that calls for us to be open to what's going on, ready for what surprises await us. It takes us to a much deeper place than a merely rational, intellectual consideration can ever take us, a place where we see unity rather than division. I spoke of the way radio itself was a kind of Ainoma space, where my voice is both here in the studio and also there with you wherever you are, and the place where we meet is somewhere in the ethereal net where the radio waves or internet waves vibrate, neither here nor there. We looked at a Kinks song. No, we didn't. We listened to a Kinks song about standing in the zoo in front of a cage, both looking at the animal and being looked at by the animal. And I can't quite tell who's looking at who, because I'm an animal too. He's both the man visiting the zoo and one of the animals on display, and the moment of unity occurs when he realizes we're all animals too. A funny song, but also poignant, with a kind of Latin beat, I think we can say, to keep it always a little off-kilter, the unsure Ainoma feel. We looked at the way people can come into an Ainoma space at work when they enter fully into the moment, and even when the work is monotonous and they find themselves at a distance from their ordinary selves, as Stevenson was when canoeing for long stretches down the French River, when, as he said, I had dwindled into quite a little thing in a corner of myself, Thoughts presented themselves unbidden. They were not my thoughts. They were plainly someone else's. And I considered them like a part of the landscape. I take it, in short, that I was about as near nirvana as would be convenient in practical life. So that's Einoma, a kind of antechamber to nirvana. We looked at several passages from T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets, which, I said, can be seen as Eliot's attempt to define this Einoma state in a succession of different ways, including the image of sitting in the evening under lamplight, looking at the photograph album, neither here nor there, but also both here and there, in the pictures before us. And we looked also at the art of dying, of finding the space, as Ram Dass put it, when we are neither grabbing at life nor pushing it away, waiting for a dissolving of boundaries, a speeding up of awareness, a kind of opening and expanding. I was a little afraid that it would be a very heavy show, but I think it also turned out to be as much light as it was heavy. I had several responses thanking me for taking us to this place and, well, not to wear out a good thing. I thought maybe I should take the discussion a few steps further this month. I want especially to attend to the way the Einoma space sets up a relationship between us and various imaginative and creative activities. But before we can find space for an Einoma experience, we have, I suspect, to clear our mind of all the chatter and clatter going on there, to give our imagination some room. In the Western tradition, this is called kenosis, the emptying of the mind. But before we can empty the mind, we have to be aware of just how cluttered it is, and that's what we'll discover in our first song. Like last time, we'll start with the Kinks. Here's a plaintive song about having too much on his mind. There's too much on my mind, and I can't sleep at night thinking about it. You see, it's bad enough having lots of thoughts on your mind, but then to have the extra layer of thoughts about our thoughts, well, then we know it's too much. This could be a depressing song, but I think Ray Davis goes on so much about this and has such fun playing with words and rhythm and adding that elegant harpsichord in the background that the song turns into a gentle self-mockery, which may be the only way he can, at least temporarily, pull himself out of this.
There's too much on my mind. There's too much on my mind. And I can't sleep at night thinking about it. I'm
too much on my mind, and there is nothing I can say.
Okay, that was The Kinks with Too Much on My Mind, written when Ray was only about 22. He sounds about, what, 52, 62, 82? It seems there's more to life than just to live it. Yep, that's right. Here's one of Ray Davies' platitudes, spoken with a naive tone, as though wondering at the complexity of life. Well, in one sense, of course, there is nothing more to do in life but live it. And yet, there is also the need to step back and examine our life. Remember what Socrates told us, the unexamined life is not worth living. Freed from the attachments that keep us restless and unable to sleep at night. And that's the Einoma state, after all. We are both in life and standing apart from life, in touch with both. It's like that state Stevenson spoke about last time as the best everyday description of Einoma. It may be best figured by supposing yourself to get dead drunk and yet keep sober to enjoy it. There's more to being drunk, we might say, than just drinking. There's also the enjoyment of it. And for that, we need a certain sobriety. Drunk and sober at the same time, the agility of Einoma. One of the features of the Einoma space, I think, is a kind of blurring of objectivity. As I said last time, we are in the Hermes field, the place where logic and clear distinctions no longer operate. We don't want to see objectively because that means we see others as objects, as things. Things are there only to be used, and we don't want to use anything but to establish relationships. In Martin Buber's terms, the Einoma sets up a world of I-thou rather than I-it. And it's our imagination that is at work here. I always go back to Coleridge's definition of the imagination as that faculty in us that joins the head and heart. We use our intellect to see what is going on, and as in any relationship, we are interested in seeing three things: the other, ourselves, and the relationship itself. And we also open our hearts to feel what is going on, and this feeling is what shows us the value of what we are connecting to. The imagination brings us to an Einoma state in which we are alive in both our head and our heart at the same time. I hope that's not too heavy, but it's always good to start with a few definitions so we know where we are. Now let's apply some of them. I want, in particular, to talk about the Einoma relationships we can have with various art forms. Some people treat art as an engagement with objects. They experience art in order to talk about it, to categorize it, explain it, use it to illustrate some theory they hold about sexual politics or ethics or imperialism and so on. I see nothing wrong with this, but it takes place somewhere other than the Einoma space. It doesn't set up an I-thou relationship with the art, and in a sense it is therefore, well, incomplete. We want to see art as something alive, asking for a response from us. I suppose we could call this spiritual, at least in the sense that there is some kind of spirit or movement that passes back and forth between us, a vivificator, or bringer of life, to that relationship. I was listening recently to an interview between Tammy Simon and Sylvia Nakach, part of the Sounds True series On the Edge. You can hear the series online at soundstrue.com. Sylvia is acutely aware of sounds and music as responsive aspects of our lives, and wants to teach us, too, to be aware of this. She picks up an idea from Rudolf Steiner, who said that tone is spiritual. It calls for a response and sets up a relationship. Musicians know this. Tone, as Sylvia puts it, tone is an event that calls for another tone and then another tone, and then you become part of a relationship of tones. But this isn't just a fact of music, it's a fact of all our relationships. Tone conveys the emotional feel of what we are saying, and think about it for a minute. we interact with each other much more just through the emotional overtone of what we say to each other than through any specific meaning in our words. Tone, we might say, is what calls the anima space into life. Sylvia spoke about the uses of a Shruti box, which is a kind of hand-pumped music box that produces a steady, though slightly pulsating, chord, a drone in the background. It is similar to the tambora in Indian music, which plays one resonating note throughout the whole performance. But the thing about this kind of droning chord is that it produces a tone, a resonance, a vibration beyond sound, which we can still hear after the sound has stopped. I was thinking of playing for you an example of a Shruti box, but I think it might become a little mesmerizing, and we have to be mindful on the radio that some people might be behind the wheel of a car or, as they say in the official cautions, handling heavy machinery. So let me play something with a little more variety, the opening minute or so of an alap, which is itself the opening movement of an Indian raga. Musicians and musicologists know there's a lot more to say about this form of music, but I'm not able to go into that now. Instead, I propose we just listen for a bit to this music, taken from Ravi Shankar's album, The Spirit of India. Let us attend and see if we can enter into the anima space between us and the music and open up to some sort of relationship in which the vibrational tones coming to us call up some sort of responsive tones from us. Okay, that was taken from the alap of Raga Jogeshwari from Ravi Shankar's album, The Spirit of India. And how was your relationship with that music? Were you able to empty yourself and come to some anima place where you could begin to resonate with the tones of the music, offering some kind of tone in response? Was your imagination able to fuse mind and heart, your mind focusing on the sounds and perhaps distinguishing one from another, and your heart responding? Could you balance both things at once, being in these two places at once? No? Well, don't get anxious about it. Just be cool and try another time. Becoming anxious is like opening the trap door on the stage. You fall right out of the anima space as soon as you start worrying. Okay, and let's lighten up a little now. Here's a little story, a Fraggle Rock story, which we attended to on a show several years ago, and it's time to attend once more. One morning, very early, the Fraggles are awoken by a strange sound, some kind of ethereal pipe. Everyone comes together with wonder in their eyes, still wearing their nightgowns, and out of nowhere appears a strange Fraggle named Cantus, playing the pipe, a magic pipe. "Made for me," he tells them, "many, many, many days ago. And singing the song we're about to hear, let me be your song." Very haunting, very mysterious. Cantus is open to the vibrating tones everywhere. Music grows in the rose, rock and rain and the blowing snowstorm, everything seems to sing everywhere I go. As the music resonates through the air, even the flowers open their petals in response. Cantus invites the Fraggles to sing their own song, and he will accompany them. There are no rules, and those are the rules. Red Fraggle, who had been the only one not attuned to the pipe, is only concerned to be the first in everything, and now she wants to be first to sing her song. No problem, she says. How does it go? Ah, Cantus is a wise man, and he answers, if you don't know, I can't tell you. And so Red has to find the song herself by listening to the tones that lie within her. Once she relaxes and connects to this song, then everyone else can join in with their song, and Cantus will hold them together with the musical accompaniment. That's why he sings, Let Me Be Your Song. Cantus, in a way, personifies this Einema moment for the Fraggles. There is the song lying dormant or gestating within the Fraggle, and there is the Fraggle, who is the one who can, by singing, express the song, set it vibrating. The two parts have to come together. Cantus is a kind of shape-shifter. He takes on the shape both of the singer and of the song. As he says in his song, I say one, two, play me do, let me sound as sweet as you, play me wide, play me long, let me be your song.
Music grows in the rose, rock and rain and the blowing snowstorm, everything seems to sing. Everywhere I go, I say one, two, play me do, let me sound as sweet as you, play me wide, play me long, let me be your song. Lay me down on the ground, song comes singing from the midnight places. Raise me high in the sky, song comes drifting through. I say one, two, play me do, let me sound as sweet as you. Play me wide, play me long, let me be your song. Play me high, play me low, play me where the wild wind's blowing, play me wide, play me long, play me for your song. I say one, two, play me do, let me sound as sweet as you. Play me wide, play me long, let me be your song. And rain and the blowing snowstorm, everything seems to sing everywhere I go. I say one, two, play me do, let me sound as sweet as you. Play me wide, play me long, let me be your song. Singing from the midnight places, raise me high in the sky, song comes drifting through. I say one, two, play me do, let me sound as sweet as you. Play me wide, play me long, let me be your song. Play me high, play me low. Play me where the wild winds blowin'. Play me wide, play me long. Play me for your song. I say one, two, play me do. Let me sound as sweet as you. Play me wide, play me long. Let me be your song.
Well, it's always a wonderful refreshment to play a Fraggle Rock song here on Evening Under Lamplight. And that was Let Me Be Your Song. You can even see a video of this moment from one of the episodes if you look on YouTube. And this, as far as this is, as I've just said, Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105, community radio in Cambridge, with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson. That Fraggle Rock story was a nice story of the Einema space between the singer and the song, where we have to find ourselves if we are to express tones true to ourselves. But now, if I may, I'd like to tell you another story, this one shifting things around a little. In this story, the singer is not the one who takes the initiative. The song chases the singer. Or perhaps not the song, but any art form. We are dealing here with Apollo, the god of the arts, the one who shines with bright light and harmony, the ideal of all artistic vision. But there's something odd about Apollo. He seems to be the only one of the major gods in Greek mythology who has bad luck with women. All the others, Zeus in particular, just see a beautiful mortal, man or woman, and come down to take that person, and if it's a woman, to impregnate her. This is a mythic depiction of inspiration, but that's a topic for some other time. Maybe it's because Apollo treats women with greater respect than Zeus does, and maybe that gives the women time to turn from him. But in any case, there is something sad and very touching about his efforts to love mortals. And I wonder if this may be telling us something about the sad, touching relationship between all artists and their work. Before we start the story, let's settle ourselves into an appropriate mood or resonance with this Delphic hymn to Apollo, a performance of a genuine piece of ancient Greek music played on the lyre by Michael Levy. Once upon a time, in the early days of the created world, Apollo, who had shot down rays of sunshine onto the earth like shooting arrows from a bow, Apollo came across young Cupid, playing with his small bow and its love shafts. "Ha," said Apollo, What puny arrows you have! Mine are much mightier than yours, and in fact I've just saved the world by killing the monster python. Oh, said Cupid, my arrows are puny, are they? I think you'd better take back those words or you'll be sorry. Sorry? Why, what are you going to do? Give me a little scratch from those little splinters you shoot from your bow? You'll see, said Cupid. And Cupid waited for just the right time. He waited until Apollo was walking around on Earth, just coming near a beautiful nymph called Daphne. Cupid took a gold-tipped arrow from his quiver and shot it at Apollo. The gold arrows made anyone, even scratched with them, fall immediately and passionately in love with whomever the person saw next. Apollo saw Daphne and fell immediately and passionately in love with her. Then Cupid took one of his lead-tipped arrows, which had the opposite effect. Whoever was hit by these arrows would take an immediate and passionate disliking to whomever the person saw next. He shot Daphne with one of these arrows. She turned and saw Apollo casting loving eyes on her, and she immediately ran from him. Daphne was an athlete, athletics being always in Greek myth a sign that the person is not interested in love or sex. And she had always avoided any thought of marriage, even when her father started nagging her about grandchildren. But now her distaste for men was focused in the rejection of this one man, no, God's, love for her. As an athlete, Daphne was able to run very fast. It was a furious chase, but as Ovid tells it, Apollo was still able to contemplate her beauty as he ran. Here, as usual, I am using A.D. Melville's translation, staying with a local Cambridge scholar. Notice the way Apollo is a true lover, focusing on his beloved, not on himself. Apollo sees the loose disorder of her hair and thinks, what if it were neat and elegant? He sees her eyes shining like stars, her lips, but looking's not enough, her fingers, hands, her wrists, her half-bare arms, how exquisite! And sure, her hidden charms are best. But she flies swifter than the light-foot wind, nor stops to hear him calling, stay, sweet nymph, oh, stay! I am no foe to fear. Lambs flee from wolves, and hinds from lions, and the fluttering doves from eagles. Every creature flies its foes. But love spurs my pursuit. And here his pleas become a little comically tender, I think. He's worried that she shouldn't hurt herself running away from him so fast. He's almost like a nagging mother telling her kid not to run so fast, she'll get hurt. Oh, he says, you will fall and briars graze your legs for shame, and I, alas, the cause of your distress. The ground you race across is rough. You run too fast. Check your swift flight, and I'll not chase so fast. I love that. He cares so much for her that he chases her at top speed to embrace her, but he loves her even more than he desires to hold her, and he says he'll go slower to protect her from getting hurt. The chase becomes a kind of game. But what kind of game? We'll see later. Then Apollo moves to a different plea. You don't know who I am, he says. You don't know whom you're running from. I am the god of prophecy, and I shape the harmony of song and strings. I am the god of medicine and healing, and yet I cannot heal myself of my love for you. Of course, these words mean nothing to her, and the race went on for some time. He sped by hope, and she by fear. Finally, she began to get tired, but at this point they came within sight of Daphne's father, the river god Peneus. Help me, father, Daphne called out. You're a water god and have the power to alter shapes. Change me and destroy my baleful beauty that has pleased too well. And before she could finish saying this, her body began to change in one of Ovid's celebrated descriptions of metamorphosis. Through her limbs a dragging languor spread. Her tender bosom was wrapped in thin, smooth bark. Her slender arms were changed to branches, and her hair to leaves. Her feet, but now so swift, were anchored fast in numb, stiff roots. Her face and head became the crown of a green tree. All that remained of Daphne was her shining loveliness. Daphne had been transformed into a laurel tree or bay tree. Apollo, now able to embrace her, put his arms around her trunk and could feel her heart still beating beneath the bark. He tried to kiss her, but the wood recoiled from his kisses. "Well," said Apollo, "since you will not be my bride..." Notice he speaks of marrying her, which is more than most of the other gods would have thought of. "Since you will not be my bride, then at least be my special tree. I am the god of glowing excellence in the arts, in politics, in warfare. And from now on, anyone who excels in triumph will be crowned with a wreath of laurel leaves." Thus spoke the god. The laurel, in assent, inclined her new-made branches and bent down, or seemed to bend, her head, her leafy crown. Yes, I thought we needed a little Smokey Robinson and the Miracles mellow love song. That was My Love for You, which sort of fits into the end of the Daphne and Apollo story. The tone, anyway, would resonate, I think, even though there's always something about the Miracles' background harmony that would make Apollo wince. But let's get back to the story. Daphne fled from Apollo, but in the end transformed into a laurel tree. Daphne is the Greek word for laurel, and so at one level this is what's called an etiological myth, that is, a story that explains how something came to be. How did laurel trees first appear on Earth? Well, let me tell you a story about someone called Daphne, or Laurel. It's also an etiological myth about how it comes about that great heroes in the fields of Apollo were crowned with laurel wreaths in ancient days. There are some other ways to understand the story, such as seeing it as the story of arrested development. This adolescent refuses to mature into womanhood. She wants to remain a young virgin forever, and she runs to her daddy to help keep this man away from her. That way of looking at the story works, at least for part of the story, but I'm a little concerned that it doesn't really fit in with the ending, or with what is the most striking part of the story for me, Apollo's very touching concern for her. If we're seeing this as a story of a man's intrusive pursuit of a girl, the kind of story that our culture seems very much on the lookout for, then Apollo just becomes a dirty old man, at the end running his sweaty hands over the bark of the tree and feeling her heartbeat underneath. I don't see that this provides any sort of resolution to the story. It leaves the story feeling incomplete. Is there a more artistically satisfactory way to read this tale? Well, yes, of course, I think there is, or I wouldn't have brought the story up this evening under lamplight, would I? Here's how I propose seeing the story. It's not that easy to explain, and I hope I managed to get across to you what I have in mind. In the mythic stories, especially those in Ovid's Metamorphoses, when a character undergoes a transformation or metamorphosis, we can take this new appearance as an image of what that character had been really like before. Thus, in the story of Arachne, the skilled weaver who challenged Minerva to a weaving match and was transformed by Minerva into a spider, the spider does not only represent Arachne's intricate and beautiful weaving, but also shows us her character. She had been a self-centered woman who used her talents only so people would flock to see her work and admire her. Thus, she becomes depicted as a spider, that creature sitting in the center of its web, waiting to attract and feed off anything that comes its way. So, when I look at the Daphne and Apollo story, I want to start first of all with the transformation. Daphne becomes transformed into the tree that symbolizes excellence, specifically for us this evening, excellence in the arts. If this represents something that had been a part of Daphne's character all along, well then we want to ask, what running from Apollo has to do with excellence in the arts? You'd think the excellent artist would instead run towards Apollo. But I suspect that this myth shows us that the relationship, the einoma relationship, remember, between the artist and the art can be more complex than this. So let's look at the story again. Apollo, creativity, loves the person who excels in creativity. The art loves the artist. The artistic vision seeks the visionary artist. That's strange, but if we let the strangeness sink in, it begins to make a little sense. But then the story tells us that the creative artist runs away from the creative vision. Why is that? I think there is something daunting about being given a vision. Art makes demands on us, just like any other relationship. And these demands seem to ask us to give up our very selves. Do you want to be an excellent singer? Then you must practice for hours each day, and you must watch your diet, and you certainly must keep your ego down. You're just the vehicle through which the song is passing, like Cantus in the Fraggle Rock song. Do you want to be an excellent architect? Forget your ego. You are now in the service of the art that has been seeking you out. This is frightening. We are Daphnes who don't want to give up what we have, in her case, that agile, sporty body. But when the spirit of the art finally comes to us, behold, we have lost our body. We are now covered in bark. We are also now laurel trees, images of artistic excellence. Well, what do you think? Is this too far-fetched? Sometimes I think this forces the story too much, but even then I know there is something truthful in this way of looking at the Daphne and Apollo story. And how does this fit into our examination of the Einoma space? Well, let's have some music first and come back to talk about that in a minute. But listen, do you think it was easy to find a song here that would fit? No, I had to think and search for a while, but I knew that the song itself, like Apollo chasing Daphne, was also looking for me, and I knew I'd know as soon as the song arrived. And here's what arrived. I think Dylan's Ballad of a Thin Man gives us a good glimpse into the confusion and fright of Daphne when she realized she was being pursued by Apollo. Here's a song about some uptight guy who walks into an art studio, called, if not by Apollo, then perhaps by one of his daughters, the Muses. But he doesn't understand, even though he tries so hard. Something is happening here, but he doesn't know what that is. Well, Mr. Jones, it's just Apollo chasing you.
You walk into the room with your pencil in your hand. You see somebody naked in you. Say, who is that man? You try so hard, but you don't understand just what you will say when you get home. Because something is happening here, but you don't know what it is. Do you, Mr. Jones? You raise up your head and you ask, is this where it is? Then somebody points to you and says, it's his. And you say, what's mine? And somebody else says, well, what is? And you say, oh my God, am I here all alone? But something is happening and you don't know what it is. Do you, Mr. Jones? You hand in your ticket and you go watch the geek who immediately walks up to you when he hears you speak. And says, how does it feel to be such a freak? And you say, impossible, as he hands you a bone. And something is happening here, but you don't know what it is. Do you, Mr. Jones? Someone attacks your imagination, but nobody has any respect anyway. They already expect you to all give a check to tax deductible charity organizations. Ah, you've been with the professors and they've all liked your looks. With great lawyers you have discussed lepers and crooks. You've been through all of F. Scott Fitzgerald's books. You're very well read, it's well known. But something is happening here and you don't know what it is. Do you, Mr. Jones? Sword swallower, he comes up to you and then he kneels
crosses himself and then he clicks his high heels. And without further notice, he asks you how it feels. And he says, here is your throat back. Thanks for the loan. And you know something is happening, but you don't know what it is. Do you, Mr. Jones? Now, you see this one-eyed midget shouting the word now. And you say, for what reason? And he says, how? And you say, what does this mean? And he screams back, you're a cow. Give me some milk or else go home. And you know something's happening, but you don't know what it is. Do you, Mr. Jones? Into the room like a camel, and then you frown. You put your eyes in your pocket and your nose on the ground. There ought to be a law against you coming around. You should be made to wear earphones, 'cause something is happening and you don't know what it is. Do you, Mr. Jones?
So that's what it can feel like when the strong power of Apollo, shining unlike anything in our ordinary life, suddenly rushes upon us. Let him, if he wants, go back to the professors who've all liked his looks. That would be safer. Now, what's happened, I think, is that Mr. Jones cannot handle the Einuma space. He's too attached to his ego, his ordinary self, to open up and allow himself to merge with that other, the creativity that comes from the Apollo within. That space between Apollo and Daphne. Remember how, although he could have caught her up, he's a god after all, Apollo always left a little space between the two of them. It's the space in which he can admire her beauty, and the space in which she can always decide to stop and turn to him. The Einuma space leaves us uncomfortable like this, and it is only when we give up ourselves and allow ourselves to be transformed, Daphne going from a young woman into a tree, that we can allow the Einuma space to come to us. Apollo will never embrace her, but only her bark and her leaves. But she consents to this, and this is the moment she becomes a symbol of excellence. This has obviously not been one of your thorough point-by-point analytical interpretations, but it needn't be. All I need to do here is to set up a few resonating tones, which can then call to you, wherever you are, setting up a space between you and these tones, inviting you to respond and set up a relationship as you create your own sense of what the Daphne and Apollo story can tell us about the creative vision. But that's enough of all this. Let's move on to another aspect of the Einuma relationship. I want to talk for a few moments about reading and the Einuma space that is created between the text and the reader. When I speak about reading, by the way, I'm also including listening, as to audiobooks or radio shows, I suppose, and lectures, and also to how we read other people, not just literature. There are three ways to read, but only one of them establishes an Einuma relationship. Some people read just to receive. They want the book to do all the work while they sit passive. These are people like those who seek pornography. These pornographic readers just want to get turned on. They're not interested in what is going on in the book, but only in what is going on inside them, getting aroused. Well, it's not just sexual arousal. Other readers go for sentimental responses, the warm fuzzies, as students sometimes say. They read only for the good feelings they hope to get. This reminds me of a friend of Flannery O'Connor's mother, who gave the short story writer Flannery O'Connor her opinion of one of Flannery's stories. "It left a bad taste in my mouth," she said. "You weren't supposed to eat it," Flannery replied. That's right. Art is not there to be used as an object to be eaten. It's all right, I suppose, to go to a book to get turned on or to get the warm fuzzies, but we're a long way from any relationship with art. You can also, after all, use the Mona Lisa to cover up a stain on your wallpaper. Or we can read just to react. We don't listen to what the text says, we just use it as a springboard to launch off on our own concerns. You read Romeo and Juliet, say, and immediately start talking about that time you fell in love with someone your parents considered one of the enemy, and about the time you climbed into her bedroom. Yeah, that's probably very interesting, but where exactly is Romeo and Juliet in all this? No, the third kind of reading, which I call responding, is the kind that shows respect for the art by opening up an Einema space in which the literature and you can come together, one tone calling forth another tone, and something new and rich and unpredictable arising from this relationship. Like every relationship, it begins in delight and ends in wisdom, as Robert Frost said about poetry. And I'm reminded that he also said that all literature is dramatic, meaning that all literature sets up a drama between writer or text and reader. We read and are challenged by the ideas or the wording, whose tone calls forth a response, and with that response we move to the next words and take in their tone and so on. In that space between, when I am neither myself nor the book, or both myself and the book, in that space grows the relationship that combines delight and wisdom and leads us, well, we don't know where. Daphne was afraid of being led somewhere she didn't know about. So, most surely, was Mr. Jones. Daphne surrendered to the relationship and flourished. Mr. Jones just put his eyes in his pocket and his nose on the ground. And here's where RLS comes in. Stevenson was a very active reader, throwing himself into whatever he was reading and responding with enormous energy. He declared with typical enthusiasm that Crime and Punishment was the greatest book I have read easily in 10 years. But his friend Henry James did not like it. James, Stevenson said, did not care for it because the character of Raskolnikov was not objective. And at that I divined a great gulf between us, and on further reflection, the existence of a certain impotence in many minds today, which prevents them from living in a book or a character, and keeps them standing afar off, spectators of a puppet show. To such, I suppose, the book may seem empty in the centre. To the others it is a room, a house of life, into which they themselves enter and are tortured and purified. Living in a book, or perhaps better, living in that Einema space created by the reader and the book together, is not always a pleasant place, but a house of life in which we are tortured and purified. That's a mighty claim for literature. Well, the old clock on the wall tells us that the Einema space you and I have shared this evening under lamplight is coming to a close. I hope I've thrown out a few sparks, or even just sparkles, to chase you into some new places. Let me know at lamplight@cambridge105.fm or at momentsunderlamplight.com. Next time, we'll try not to be so heavy. I have in mind a show of just requests and dedications. Yes, let's try our hand at that. Send me your requests and dedications, and I promise I won't be too ironic with them. And so we close this episode of Evening Under Lamplight with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, at Cambridge 105, Community Radio in Cambridge. And here's Leonard Cohen to take us out with another version of the relationship with art. Being Leonard, he did not run from Apollo, but sought him out and journeyed far. He came so far for beauty, leaving everything else behind, including his masterpiece unsigned, that is, his art free from his ego, free to experience the Einema relationship with beauty unencumbered.
Came so far for beauty, I left so much behind. My patience and my family, my masterpiece unsigned. I thought I'd be rewarded for such a lonely choice, and surely she would answer to such a very hopeless voice. I practiced on my sainthood, I gave to one and all, but the rumor of my virtue, they moved her not at all. I changed my style to silver, I changed my clothes to black, and where I would surrender, and now I would attack. I stormed the old casino for the money and the flesh, and I myself decided what was rotten and what was fresh. Men to do my bidding, and broken bones to teach the value of my pardon, the shadow of my reach. But no, I could not touch her with such a heavy hand. Her star beyond my order, her nakedness unmanned. I came so far for beauty, I left so much behind. My patience and my family, my masterpiece unsigned.